Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
Well, the cost of the escalation, just the escalation, may reach $40 billion. The cons are out there hyperventilating and bloviating about, are we going to win or lose in a war that we never should have been in the first place, an ongoing occupation now, and an ongoing civil war. Mr. Rumsfeld testifying before Congress. We'll have more information on that as we continue with the program. Right now, Robert Kohler is with us. He is an award-winning journalist, Chicago-based journalist, and editor at Tribune Media Services, a nationally syndicated writer. And his most recent piece over at CommonWonders.com is titled Caged Priests: To Our Eternal Shame We Let Inmates Dispense Justice. Robert Kohler, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I did. The reason this jumped out at me as a topic is it is so inflammatory. This would be an easy one to let pass. Yeah, we want a decent criminal, justice system, but not necessarily for a priest who's a child molester. And yet to look at the issue from the most blatant wrong that it commits, dealing with the worst kind of criminal, that was to me how we had to look at the issue.
So the larger question, I guess, you're asking the question. We're talking with Robert Kohler, award-winning Chicago-based journalist, editor at Tribune Media Services, nationally syndicated writer, and his new column, Caged Priests, is really asking the question, is our prison system the best place to put child molester priests? And I think that probably there's a broad consensus that the answer is yes, that they should be segregated and separated from society. But then the question becomes, is our prison system producing the results that it's designed to produce, beyond the segregation from society? And you point out that it has largely become a system, a punitive system, and while punishment is certainly an element of justice, there are larger issues. People reintegrate back into society. There are a lot of people in our prisons who are not violent offenders. Although I'm not putting these priests in that category. I would say that this is a form of violence. But for example, people who were caught with a joint, marijuana cigarette.
Right.
The question of, letting gangs run loose in our prisons and letting our prisons become increasingly hellholes and kind of sitting back and smugly going, yeah, they're getting what they deserve. There's something wrong with that.
Right, absolutely. And I mean, the group Critical Resistance coined the term prison industrial complex. Our prison system is growing at a very fast rate. It's gone up 400% in the last two decades. Mostly from these, this whole zero tolerance on drugs and, non-violent.
Wasn't it mostly
offenders.
Because we've privatized our prison system, we've corporatized it, and now there's a lobby for the prisons?
Right, absolutely. More and more and more. It's the private sector. The word penitentiary, the root word is penitent, and it grew out of the prison reform movement of about a century ago. But that concept has totally been lost. When you punish somebody or when you arrest and, deal with crime, what matters is the long-term, elimination of that kind of crime. And we're not doing that. We're crime is growing and, we're the most, we have the largest prison population in the world, and certainly among, you know, the rich industrial nations, we're the only one that's not bringing another consciousness to bear on what our, you know, on what it means to, you know, on what crime and punishment is all about.
Are we also the only nation in the world which has given our the commons of our prison system over to private for-profit corporations?
Probably the only nation, you know, in the industrialized world that does that, and this has been the trend since the 80s, since the Reagan era, and that's, you know, coincidentally when the explosion of our prison population began.
Yeah, let me just tell you a very, very quick story. Louis Melmadrona is a physician and MD. He's a Native American. And grew up literally from poverty on the reservation to getting his MD and a PhD and becoming a professor of medicine at the University of Arizona. And now he's teaching psychiatry up in Canada at the University of Saskatchewan. And Lewis told me the story of a group up in the Northwest Territories that he worked with, Native Americans up there. There was a young man and woman. They were, 17, 18, 19 years old, something like that. And they were in an intimate situation and beginning to get sexually involved with each other. And it reached right up to the point where it was just about to have sex. And she said no. And he said yes. And he forced her to have sex. So it was date rape, you know,
yeah,
a classic case
right,
of date rape.
Right.
The Native American community sentenced him to 2 years of serving her family.
Oh, my gosh.
He had to be essentially the slave to their family, the servant to their family, of
right.
You know, keeping their house up and mowing the lawn and, you know, 2 years of service to their family. And they felt that rebalanced it answered the crime, it rebalanced things, society, and he would still be. Well, what happened was the Canadian government found out about this because of some news report or something, and they came in and they said, no, wait a minute, this is a crime. And they ran him through the Canadian criminal justice system, had sentenced him to 2 years in prison in Canada. The entire tribe showed up at the crime saying, do not put him in prison because that will kill him, because it will break the bond between him and this community. He was put in prison anyway. He committed suicide in prison. About a year later, the girl committed suicide.
Oh, my
and,
God.
And the community was just devastated by this.
Oh,
this is
God.
A community that understands that the goal of punishment is not just punishment, but it's also restoring balance.
Right, exactly. Yes. And restorative versus retributive justice is the term.
So how do we start looking, and I don't think any of us are saying, you know, hey, let's do away with our prisons, or that, you know, molester priests shouldn't go to prison or anything like that, but how do we start, or any crime for that matter, although I think that there are a number of things like, you know, for example, possession of pot that shouldn't even be a jailable offense, but setting that aside, how do we move from a punitive system to a restorative system in the United States, particularly in the face of a billion-dollar industry that doesn't want that to happen?
Right, exactly. Well, it's just like, you know, it's just like the military industrial complex, and how do we deal with how do we deal, you know, internationally, other than by preemptive carpet bombing? It's both of them are these enormously entrenched systems, but what has to happen is first the awareness that there is something possible, then assaulting the problem in the media, blitzing the problem. There just has to be more and more awareness out there. It certainly won't be easy. But the story you told, there are many stories. I mean, after I wrote that column, I got a lot of mail, and a lot of them were stories similar to what you're talking about, either that they knew of personally, or they had, you know, seen a film about, or they had heard about, where, you know, like the criminal and the victim were able to confront each other or meet together, and something happened that brought about restoration. And that doesn't mean, you know, that there shouldn't be some punishment, but punishment is the least of what has to happen when a crime is committed. Restoring the victim and the community to wholeness is what has to happen. And then getting through to the perpetrator so that he or she understands the wrong that they did and their life changes and they don't do it again. That's right. The point.
We need a fundamental reform in this country.
Absolutely.
Robert, Bob Kohler, you have written a fascinating column. I hope a lot of people check it out over at commonwonders.com. Robert Kohler, award-winning Chicago-based journalist, Tribune editor at Tribune Media Services. Thanks a lot for being with us, Bob.
Okay, thanks, Tom. Great to talk to you.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Stick around for an update on Rumsfeld's testimony before Congress.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. Paul Rykoff is with us. He is the executive director and founder of Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America, the author of Chasing Ghosts, the website IAVA.org. And Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, sir. Good to be with you.
Pleased to have you. You were, I'm sure, quite carefully watching the testimony of Mr. Rumsfeld here before Congress today.
Absolutely. I think most veterans who've served in Iraq and Afghanistan have been tracking this story pretty closely from the beginning.
So tell us, you know, what happened and what your take on it is, please.
Well, this is kind of vintage Rumsfeld. I mean, he's spinning and he's spouting these weird rhetorical terms, and it's just it feels like a flashback to 2003, 2004, where he really doesn't answer any questions and seems to dodge any real probing inquiries into what happened. And I think the bottom line here is that the Pat Tillman situation has been a national embarrassment, and it happened under his watch. And I think what we're seeing now is that there is a much deeper issue going on here. There was some sort of a cover-up. People within the military have already been held accountable, and the family deserves answers. Mary Tillman has been very vocal from the beginning of this, and I just want to say that veterans stand behind that family and their quest to get to the bottom of what really happened on the ground.
Now, Don Rumsfeld said two interesting things in the testimony this morning. One, he said, General Myers said, I don't think there's any regulation that would require me to do anything with regard to informing the White House. And then the guy above Myers, Defense Secretary or ex-Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld, said, and I quote, I know that I would not engage in a cover-up. I know that no one in the White House suggested such a thing to me. I know that the gentlemen sitting next to me are men of enormous integrity and would not participate in something like that. So he didn't specifically deny that he engaged in it. He said he would not, which is a rhetorical statement rather than a categorical statement. So the question, do you think that these guys actually did engage in a cover-up, or did this three-star general who was just censured, was he the guy that it stopped with? And if so, why is George W. Bush saying that he will not turn over papers from his office that have to do with what happened to Pat Tillman?
I think what this all sounds like is like they've all been taking lessons from Roberto Gonzalez. These are the same types of answers we heard from him. And I think that there's probably legal ramifications to what they say today, and they're conscious of that. There was some sort of cover-up. And if the president didn't know, the chain of command failed. Anybody who's president of the United States knows about the high visibility of someone like Pat Tillman. He was a national hero, even before he was killed. So if he didn't know, somebody failed. If he did know and participated in the cover-up, well, that's an entirely, you know, another set of situations that we've got to deal with as well. But it was clear that people within the chain of command knew. There was at least one flag grade officer general who knew that the terms on the ground, the situation on the ground was suspect and failed to inform the family. So this went pretty deep, and we don't know where it stopped. And I think that's why we need this type of a hearing. We need a full investigation, and we can't stop until we know how many people were involved, how high it went, because we've really got to try to regain our credibility here as a nation. We ask people to sign up and join the military, trusting that, they'll be told the truth and that their families will be told the truth, especially when they give this huge sacrifice of their life. So I think we've really got to think beyond just this Tillman case and talk about how it affects our country and our military's presence and standing within the American population.
We're talking with Paul Rykoff, the executive director and founder of Iraq, Afghanistan, Veterans of America, and the author of an extraordinary book, Chasing Ghosts, IAVA.org, the website. Paul, I mean, you really have your ear to the ground with regard to these issues, particularly with regard to the issues having to do with Afghanistan and Iraq, people coming back, talking to you and talking to your organization. What's your take on what probably actually happened in the Tillman case, and what's your sense of, or what information do you have about what's going to go forward now, or have they effectively buried it by basically just censuring this general?
I don't think it's going to go away, and I think that's a testament to the family. I mean, the Tillman family, Mary Tillman, Pat's mother, and Pat's brother, who also served in the Ranger Battalion right alongside Pat, have been vocal and aggressive on advocating for this case going forward. So I think until their dying day or until they get the truth, they're going to keep pushing this forward.
On this day, he was separated from his brother. There is no evidence of any enemy fire having hit any of the persons or any of the equipment that was there. So apparently no firefight. I mean, isn't this increasingly looking like a conspiracy? And if so, could it have been a conspiracy from the top down, or was it most likely just a local conspiracy?
It could have come from either ways, and I think the important thing for me to say is I really don't know, and I wasn't on the ground, and that's why we need a thorough investigation. But there are a million scenarios that could have taken place. You know, Pat could have accidentally shot himself. The guy next to him could
not have three shot times him in the forehead.
Well, you know, he could have fallen on his weapon. I mean, there's a lot, and you know, there's a three-shot burst that comes out of an M16 or an M4 when you pull the trigger once. I mean, there are a million scenarios that could have happened. And I think those of us who've been in combat and been on the ground understand that there are so many different scenarios that could take place. I don't necessarily buy into the conspiracy theories right away that he was murdered by somebody within his unit, but it was clear that there was some kind of a cover-up at the lower levels and at the top, and we got to get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, well said. Paul Rykoff, executive director and founder of Iraq, Afghanistan, Veterans of America. Author of Chasing Ghosts, IAVA.org, the website. Paul, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 866-303-2270. TomHartman.com, the website. AirAmerica.com, our blog.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry.
Yeah, the whole issue of what should we do with our prison system, the number one starting point in my mind is buy it back from the private for-profit corporations that we have handed it off to and renationalize our prison system so we can get back to the business of doing what's the right thing for society rather than what's the right thing for investors. By the way, just a quick heads up, I'm going to be on the road with Leonardo DiCaprio's new feature-length documentary, The 11th Hour. There's a trailer for it up at the top of TomHartman.com, our website. Also, 11thHourFilm.com, 11thHourFilm.com. There's a trailer there as well. I'll be on the 17th, on Friday the 17th. I will be live at K-Talk in Los Angeles. We'll be doing the show live from there. And then that evening, I'll be doing a Q&A after a screening of the 11th Hour. In all cases here, the time and theater are to be announced shortly. On the following Monday, on the 20th, I'll be live in New York City for a local showing. And on the 24th, we'll be live in San Francisco from the Quake. And in New York on the 20th, we'll be doing the show live from our affiliate there, WWRL. There's also going to be a sneak preview on August 7th, next Tuesday, in New York City at 7 p.m. It'll be at the Regal Battery Park Stadium 11. and reception and Q&A immediately following that. And we will have information shortly on how people can show up for that and how all that works. So anyhow, this is a work in progress, but it's a heck of a movie. It's an extraordinary movie. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Wayne in Bales, Tennessee. Hey, Wayne, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. You kind of threw me off a bit with your guest prior to the one you had about Pat Tillman.
Robert Kohler.
Yeah, were you serious about situations where slavery would be acceptable? Just if it's connected to a crime that's been committed. I mean, were you serious about that?
I don't recall having used the word slavery, Wayne.
Well, you said that basically the guy would be a slave to that family while he was serving his 2-year sentence.
Yeah, slavery is probably the wrong word. But that was what the community worked out. And the community worked out was that this guy had to, rather than having a job or rather than having spare time, that he was at the beck and call of this family for 2 years as a form of restitution. And, you know, that's what worked out in that Native American community in the Northwest Territories. And, you know, far be it for me to judge their standards or their goal was to restore balance. Rather than to punish. And that's a really important thing. I remember years ago I was with a group of Apaches down in the southwest of the United States. I was working in their schools and around ADHD issues and whatnot, and myself and John Rady from the Harvard Medical School. And they had invited me, a group of men had invited me to participate in a ceremony. One of their daughters was going through puberty, and there's this big 3-day dance thing that goes on, and it's really an initiation ritual. It's really a very difficult and challenging ritual where this girl and her family and their friends have to dance in the sun from sunrise until sunset for 3 days, and then every night go through purification rituals. And we had done this long 30 some odd stone sweat, and we were sitting out at about midnight under the stars. It was cold in the desert in Arizona, and sitting around this campfire, and myself and a whole group of Apaches, and they were all making jokes about the Hopis up the road. And, you know, as people were just casually talking, you know, a bunch of guys just talking, and I didn't know any Hopi jokes. So I made a joke at the expense of the guy sitting across from me in the circle. You know, a put-down joke, you know, a Jerry Seinfeld kind of joke. And all of a sudden, the entire circle just went silent. Everybody was looking down at the ground, and I realized I had committed, you know, a crime. I had done something that was highly inappropriate in their culture, which was to insult somebody in front of himself and other people. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure what to do, you know. And after a long and painful minute or two, the guy just to my left, who was the oldest man in the group, says, I remember when I was young and stupid and I insulted a friend of mine. We were in boarding school, and he tells his whole story, right? And then he tells how he made it right. And then the guy next to him tells his story of one time that he did exactly what I did and how he made it right. And then the guy that I insulted tells his story of how this happened to him, you know, how he did something like this and how he made it right. And the guy next to him tells his story. And Paul, my friend who's sitting right on my right, tells his story. And by the time it got around to me, I figured out two things. One, that this is a culture that historically is not about punishment. They're about restoring balance. And that's what they were doing in that in that case.
But,
and two, they had taught me how to restore balance with this guy, which I did. And that's my point, that the community in the Northwest Territories was interested in restoring balance between this young man and the woman that he had date raped and working it out. And for him, for her, and for their society. And when the government of Canada came in and said, no, we've got laws, we're going to do it this way, and sent him off to jail, it threw the entire community out of balance and destroyed it. Not that there should be no penalty for date rape. You know, that's obviously not my point.
But my point is this, is that I wouldn't want to be a part of a community like that or any society that operates that way.
Okay. You would rather be in a society where if you commit a crime, then you get put in a prison where you yourself are raped and you yourself are a slave to that prison system.
Well, if you understand just exactly what the laws of the land are, you're going to just decide to impose your beliefs or your desires on somebody else. Then, you know, you don't do the crime if you don't want to do the time, and you know what's going to happen in a situation like that. So it wasn't as if he was unaware of what the penalties could be.
I mean, well, Yes and no. I mean, this actually, he was a Native American who was part of a very remote community in the Northwest Territories of Canada who probably didn't know what the federal Canadian penalties were. But nonetheless, the point of, you know, you need to know the law. Yes, I'm not saying that the laws need to be changed. I'm saying that prisons, or Robert Kohler, his point, and I agree with it, that prisons should have, in addition to punishment, as their primary goal, restoration. This is where the word, you know, from the penitentiary, penitence of restoring balance, of healing people, because these people are going to go back into their communities. And right now, what we have is people coming out of our prisons, going back into their communities, severely damaged and not repaired in any way. They're worse criminals than when they went to jail, and that's not a good thing for any of us.
Well, rehabilitation is important, but how can you rehabilitate somebody if, for example, this guy has a mental problem? We don't look at sexual predators in a lot of cases as if they're mentally ill. We stop short of that, and the remedy, of course, is a prison sentence, and there's no real treatment involved.
Right, and thus the tragedy, and not just sexual predators. I would say the same with substance abusers.
And that's all I'm just concerned about is that, you know, if that's a society, if that's the way they do it, that's okay. But I'm saying I kind of steer clear of people who look at things that way, and ritual dancing all day and all that. That's kind of weird.
It's just different. It's, you know, our society and that society, they're different societies. But I think that, you know, it's useful probably for all of us to respect those societies. In fact, it's important for us to, because when we don't respect societies, we end up with our soldiers going into cultures that they don't understand, calling people, you know, slurs and treating them in ways that cause the whole situation to blow up in their faces.
But I wouldn't do that. I'm just saying, okay, I've come in contact with a different culture and I see how it is and I can respect that, but they're going to have to respect the fact that I ain't into it, okay?
Yeah. Right. No, I got your point, Wayne. I got your point, and well said. Thank you very much for the call. Ken in Queens, New York. Hey, Ken. Oh, I'm sorry. We got Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Ralph.
Yeah, Tom. Different topic, although the concept of law in the Pacific Northwest is fascinating. Basically this. We've got a real problem with our generals, and I think Congress should begin taking away a lot of generals' pensions and benefits for dereliction of duty. Generals owe their oath, and our military owes its oath to the Constitution, not to Rumsfeld, not to Bush. The military oath is to protect and defend the Constitution, not the
president. True also, by the way, of our elected officials.
Oh, precisely. But the problem that we're seeing is the first three words, as you keep pointing out every time your program ends, for the Constitution is a thing called we the people. What the generals have sworn and the military has sworn to protect is we the people. You can't have we the people in control of what's going on in the United States if our generals keep lying to us.
Yeah.
That's the dereliction of their duty. We have a whole bunch of bobbleheads every time the president says something, they want a promotion, and a whole constellation of stars, the Pentagon says, oh, yes, sir, three bags full.
Mm-hmm.
They need, the generals need, in order to fulfill their duty, to tell us, the American people, the truth. Because that's the only thing that's going to save American soldiers.
Your point is well taken, and I would say in the context of Rumsfeld's and Meyer's testimony this morning before Henry Waxman's committee, that I would have been much happier, and I think probably most Americans would have been much happier, if what they did was they came before the committee and they said, yes, this was a terrible thing, and yes, we have instituted an investigation, and here is what we have found, rather than saying things like General Myers saying, I don't think there's any regulation that would require me to do anything with regard to Pat Tillman. I mean, say what?
But Tom,
this is about regulations? You're absolutely right. You know, your comment that it's about the Constitution, it's about we the people. I mean, I agree with you. That's what it should be about.
But Tom, that's the thing. You talk about crime and punishment. The generals have no punishment for lying.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're welcome. Yeah. Crime and punishment punish the generals. Interesting. Yeah. Polar pension. Well, this is what's happened, apparently, to the one general who was clearly involved in a cover-up. Is that there has been a punishment to him, and it may be even more extreme, but But very often that's used, like it was with Lindy England, simply to stop the investigation. That's wrong.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes before the hour. The Bush administration, by the way, up at the top of the Washington Post today, the Bush administration, Dan Eggen writing the Washington Post, the Bush administration's chief intelligence official said yesterday that President Bush authorized a series of secret surveillance activities under a single executive order in late 2001. The disclosure makes clear that a controversial NSA program was part of a much broader operation than the president previously disclosed. This is the thing that back when Gonzo was testifying and he said, well, that was not the TSP program we were arguing about. I was saying on the air, it sounds to me like what we have, or looks to me like what we have here, get a sense that what's going on here is that Bush has been spying on us in ways that are so egregious and so heinous and so illegal that he has not even shared it with members of the intelligence committees in Congress. And it's only coming out now because they're trying to keep Gonzo from going to jail or being impeached because they need him to protect Bush from himself being the subject of criminal trials or impeachment. So here we have Mike McConnell, the director of national intelligence, coming out and saying, no, there's more here. There's more going on here. Is this going to be the thing that blocks Gonzalez from going down, or is this going to be the thing that the thread that gets pulled on that unravels an entire web of bizarre corruption? And speaking of general craziness, it's a lot of craziness around right now. Our crazy alert.
Maybe you're crazy. Maybe we're crazy. Probably.
This particular crazy alert just kind of stands on its own. I was waiting for the jokes to start about Judge Roberts choking on a pretzel, but instead it's even weirder than that. Michael Weiner, also known as Michael Savage.
Am I to believe that there's no connection between Charles Schumer on Friday saying that he would never appoint, or never, excuse me, approve another Bush appointment to the court, to any court, and then the Chief Justice suffers a so-called seizure 2 days later? You're telling me there's no possibility of a conspiracy by the Democrats to have caused this seizure in some manner? Tell me that it's not possible. Tell me that the stakes are not so high that the liberals have finally lost the court after 50 years that they would stop short of anything like this. Tell me it's not possible, and I'll tell you you're a liar.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'll tell you, Michael, it's not possible. It's not possible. What a tragedy. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Is it Sabin or Sabine in Santa Fe, New Mexico?
Sabin.
I'm sorry. I miss both of them. So what's up?
Well, I was calling about the first never-ending war, which was the war on drugs.
Right.
You were talking about prisons, and you were talking about private prisons and the profitability of them.
Yes.
But we can't stop just at looking at the private prisons, because it's the vendors that supply, for instance, the federal prisons. It's the same cronies that are making money off the war in Iraq, that make money off of providing food to the prisons here, telephone service to the prisons here.
And military equipment and training to the prisons here?
Yeah,
absolutely. And that's the problem, is by privatizing part of the commons, we have produced this huge dislocation to where now we have a situation where the private prison industry and the private for-profit industry that supports even the federal and state prisons, the nationalized prisons, are among the leaders in the movement to keep the so-called war on drugs going and ramp it up, because it creates more customers for them. And that's just absolutely bizarre. You, in a democracy, the reason you don't privatize these things is because you don't want to have a situation where people have an incentive to lock more people up. It's crazy. Ken in Queens, New York. Hey, Ken.
Hey, I'm no constitutional scholar, but it seems to me that if the criminals are selling the Saudis $20 billion worth of arms, and the Saudis are the ones who are teaching their children to kill Americans in madrasas, and if they were the ones responsible...
Not just Americans. The Saudis are the ones that are teaching their children in their schools the Jews in Israel are you know, subhuman and not worthy of continuing to exist.
Right, but as much to the point, if the Saudis now are among those infiltrating into Iraq to support the Sunnis, well, isn't that aiding and abetting the enemy by selling them arms to kill our own troops?
Yeah, and 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis, too.
Right, and so selling them arms to kill us, isn't that aiding and abetting the enemy, which is defined as treason in the Constitution?
I think that could be defined as such.
Well,
let me back away from that, because we have a relationship with Saudi Arabia. What this points out is that this whole issue of what happened on 9/11 and the ongoing things that are happening in Saudi Arabia with regard to their promoting violent jihad need to be dealt with, A, at the criminal level, and B, at the diplomatic level. And frankly, I don't think that it would serve any, you know, our purposes or anybody else's purpose to say that this is treason. But the fact of the matter is that the Saudi government and members of the Saudi royal family and those affiliated with it over the last 30 years, have transferred over $1 billion worth of wealth into the Bush family or entities associated with the Bush family. And, you know, they're getting paid back.
Isn't it treasonous to, in effect, keep this country addicted to oil, wage war for oil, and at the same time not develop alternative means? We could leave that region and do what they want to each other.
I would argue, Ken, that it is morally treasonous. I'm not sure that we could build a case that it is legally treasonous, but I get your point and broadly don't disagree with it. At the level of morality, at the level of what's the right thing for America, at the level of, you know, how government should be functioning, spot on. Well said. Thank you, Ken. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
Exposing the con in conservative, this is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
537 days, 11 hours, 48 minutes, 22 seconds until George W. Bush voluntarily leaves office, assuming that there is not an impeachment against him. And interestingly, shortly after Howard Dean pointed out that the Democrats swept Ohio in the 2006 elections in his opinion, in part because of the presence of progressive talk radio on four stations, as I recall, in the state of Ohio, they all vanished. Odd. So if you go over to Wikipedia and you look up Fairness Doctrine, it says that the Fairness Doctrine debate has, and I'm paraphrasing, I looked at it a few hours ago, don't have it right in front of me right now, but essentially the language says that this whole debate got new life when the Center for American Progress called for a reinstatement of the Fairness Doctrine. Mark Lloyd is with us. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and an affiliated professor at Georgetown Public Policy Institute. And Mark, Wikipedia got it wrong again, right?
Yeah, you can't trust Wikipedia. You got to go to the source. So.
It's amazing. Some right winger got in there and changed the entry on Wikipedia. I'm just astounded.
Well, this is what these guys have done with history. So we've got Ronald Reagan as the greatest president since I don't know Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln.
This is
what they do. Yeah.
Yeah. Mark Lloyd, the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. The study that you guys did suggest, and we've discussed this many times on this program. I'm guessing that most of our listeners are relatively familiar with it, and it was talking more about media consolidation than actually in the study or in the conclusions of the study. You dismissed the fairness doctrine, did you not?
Well, that's right. I mean, you're absolutely right. Our focus is on ownership. Our focus is on the empowerment of the local citizens vis-a-vis the broadcast institutions that are licensed in their community to serve them, and bringing some meaning to that license. So we weren't talking about really the fairness doctrine at all, and argued that any focus on the fairness doctrine misses the core problem.
Right. Now, in the next segment, we're going to have on Roger Aronoff with Accuracy in Media, the right-wing group, who is out there aggressively promulgating the idea that you guys and progressives in general are in favor of the fairness doctrine. I frankly don't want a government agency deciding how much time I should spend on a topic or how much time a radio station should spend on a topic. But frankly, that's even not what the fairness doctrine said. I mean, and this is part of the problem with even using the phrase fairness doctrine, because conservatives have reinvented it to be a straw boogeyman that never even existed.
Well, that's absolutely right. And so, I mean, I'm sort of happy to talk about how the fairness doctrine operated, both as a former public service director and a lawyer who used to advise broadcasters. And I'm happy to talk about that. But again, that's not the point. And so what the right has been very, very successful at doing is changing the debate, talk about something that they want to talk about because they think they can win on that. We're not talking about the fairness doctrine. We're talking about ownership. You've got a radio group that can own over 1,200 radio stations in this country. We're saying that's too much.
Oddly enough, that radio group, that would be Clear Channel, it carries about 80% of the total programming of this network. And frankly, I'm of the opinion that one of the reasons they do is because they're interested in making money. We're making money for them. But you have other radio groups that are owned by companies that have interlocking boards with defense contractors, or that in fact are defense contractors that have no interest in this kind of programming. And that, I don't want to lay that out as a conspiracy theory, but it certainly would happen to Phil Donahue on MSNBC, back in the day when he was talking about the Iraq War.
Oh, sure. I mean, so our argument is that media consolidation is bad, that the greater number of owners that you have, the more diversity of opinion, whether it's left or right or just local, then you'll get stuff that will actually serve the American public. And we don't have that now because of concentration.
Yeah. Now, although if there was no concentration, but there was a broad sense among the owners of talk radio stations that they themselves were conservatives, you could end up with the same result, could you not?
Yeah, that's right. But again, we don't anticipate that result. I mean, what we think will happen is that if you have more diverse owners, if you have small businesses, if you've got local groups, if you've got folks, and again, the power of the local community to say, after 3 years, this guy that you've given a license, you federal government, really isn't serving our interests, and does he really deserve to have another license? And with that sort of pressure, you will have folks who will put programming on that actually serves the local interest. 100% conservative talk in Philadelphia is just, how can anyone even argue that represents the consumer interest? Forget about the political interest.
Well, what I'm curious about is how can anyone argue that that represents the commercial interest?
Oh, exactly.
Because if I owned a radio station in Philadelphia that was underperforming, and this is one of the top 10 markets in the United States, and there's no progressive programming there, I'd be saying, hey, you know, I've got a station here that's playing golden oldies or something, and I'm not making any money. I should at least try this progressive format that seems to be making money in Seattle and San Francisco and Portland and New York. And I mean, we're doing well in a lot of cities around the country.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Talk show hosts like you, like Ed Schultz, like a few others, are actually doing very well in a variety of markets, competing successfully. Competing successfully in New York, you're competing successfully in Chicago. Like, why aren't you as syndicated as Michael Savage or some of these other nut jobs? And so part of the argument is that we have a distortion of the market put in place by government rules. We need to fix those government rules. And it's not about the fairness doctrine. It's about making sure the market actually works to get the people in local communities to talk or music, whatever it is that they want.
Why is it then that John Kerry and Dick Durbin and a couple of other senators have come out and said that they think that we should bring back the fairness doctrine? Did they simply misspeak? Has there been a change in opinion? Are they continuing to hold that opinion? Or were they talking about something that they just didn't even understand?
Well, I mean, my understanding in speaking with staff is that senators were not prepared, were not really thinking, don't know what the fairness doctrine is, and really talked about looking at it. But I've talked with, you know, a couple of senators about this. There was no intention on the Democratic senators' part, as I understand it, to say, we're going to return the fairness doctrine. They were reacting to the right.
Has been legislation to return the fairness doctrine introduced into Congress. In fact, in one case, it was vetoed by Ronald Reagan.
Oh, yeah.
It passed the Congress.
There was legislation introduced in Congress after the FCC said we're not going to enforce the fairness doctrine. The argument was that Congress actually required the FCC to enforce the doctrine and put that in Section 315 of the Communications Act. I'm sorry, you are talking to a lawyer. And then members of Congress said the courts got it wrong. We did require the FCC to, you know, require licensees to be fair. And right. We want to make sure that that's clear. Well, you know, they tried to pass that. Again, during the Reagan administration, they tried to pass it during the Bush administration. Louise Lauder introduced it during the last Congress. But again, that's not our focus. Section 315 is still there. It still says that broadcasters get a license. They're supposed to provide issues of importance in
right.
a fair way to local. We think that's fine. But that's
Mark Lloyd, isn't there, we only have a minute left here, aren't there two possible middle grounds here? One being to say that, to go back to the old concept that in order to have a license, you have to provide programming in the public interest at some level. However, you know, in a rather
exactly.
vague fashion, number one. And secondly, rather than saying that we're going to break up. Well, actually, just why don't you address that one first?
Which one?
The idea of programming in the public interest. I think that's the really strong meme, and we only have a few seconds left.
Well, the FCC has always interpreted that very loosely, and so that has almost never gotten anybody off the air. The key is making sure that the local community is involved in determining what the public interest is, that it's not just a matter of the licensee saying, you know, we're going to buy a package of syndicated programming and, you know, whatever the advertisers support, that's what we'll put on. You've got to serve the local community. If your local programming, if your syndicated programming does that, that's fine. If it doesn't, the local community ought to be able to complain and say you don't deserve your license. I mean, that's all we're saying.
And that's a very, very much a middle ground between you have to present opposing points of view and we're going to monitor that, or you have to, you know, break up your ownership or something. One other quick possibility, what about saying that only a company that engages in the business of media can own media companies?
Oh, yeah, we think that's fine. I mean, we're in favor of looking at all the rules, but the point is
great.
We want more speech, greater diversity on the airwaves.
Got it. Mark Lloyd, AmericanProgress.org, the website. Thank you, Mark.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
show.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're discussing the Fairness Doctrine, the state of media in the United States. Roger Aronoff is with us. He's with Accuracy in Media, AIM.org, the website, the conservative group that has for many years been on the lookout for liberal bias in the media and trying to keep the media honest, at least from their point of view. Roger, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
I'm pleased to have you here with us. Roger, we were talking just a minute ago with Mark Lloyd of the Center for American Progress about the study that they did, finding that there is a radical disparity between progressive and conservative programming on radio stations across the United States. And first of all, I'm curious about your take on that.
Well, I agree that there's a lot more conservative talk radio shows on the air, but I believe that's basically the market speaking, and it has since the Fairness Doctrine was eliminated in 1987. It created kind of an explosion of conservative talk radio shows among other talk radio shows, but their concern, of course, is to do with ownership, is what they're saying. I mean, I think there are many people that want to return to the Fairness Doctrine, but they're trying to, in essence, say that their concern is more about who owns the stations than having government people come in and regulate the speech.
Yeah, that's what they're saying. In fact, I have not been able to find anybody who wants to bring back the Fairness Doctrine.
Let me just tell you, there's Louise Slaughter, Congresswoman Maurice Hinchey have introduced bills. Richard Durbin.
Most of them are pulling back from those positions, though, and they're rethinking this in the context of this Center for American Progress. Here's the question, Roger, and just a thoughtful. This is not a gotcha question. I mean, this is an honest question, and I'd love to get your take on it. I'm on the air. This program is on the air. Right now we are on the air in 6 of the 10 largest media markets in the United States, in 16 of the top 25 markets. But in the other 4 media markets in the top 10, in the other 9 markets in the top 25, it's not that we're not on the air because some other progressive show is on. It's because in each one of those markets, there are at least 3 or 4 other conservative hosts who are on in the same day part, noon to 3 Eastern time, and there are no progressive hosts on. In other words, this program, ever since I took over for Al Franken, this program is now on the air in every major market in which there is progressive talk radio. Now, take Philadelphia, for example. It's one of the top 10 media markets in the United States. And about half of all the voters in Philadelphia consistently vote Democratic. Do you really mean to say that there's not enough listener, there's not enough potential listeners in Philadelphia to make progressive or Democratic or liberal talk radio profitable?
No, I think there absolutely are enough, and many are listening on the internet right now. And why do you think that no station is carrying your network?
Well, it's a very good question. I know down in Atlanta. Well, actually, I don't know the details of that. I know the story, and I probably shouldn't tell it because I don't. But I know that there have been a couple of markets where local groups have come in and bought up stations that progressive talk radio is on and flipped them to other formats. In one case, to Christian format. In another case, to a music format, and said, to the media right out loud, we just did this because we didn't want progressive talk radio on the air in our city. I know that radio airspace is very, very tight. Getting a radio station is a major accomplishment, particularly one that'll cover an entire, listening area. It's a very limited marketplace out there.
Well,
and so, why would it be, if there's money on the ground to be made, that nobody's picking that up and making that money?
What do you think? It's some big conservative conspiracy to keep them out of the Philadelphia and other markets?
My personal opinion is that there's a herd mentality in this industry. I've worked in this industry since 1968, and not continuously, but I worked for 10 years back in the 60s and 70s as a DJ and as a news reporter for 7 years. And I've been doing this show for now. We're now in our 5th year. And I just think that there's a herd mentality. Nobody ever got fired for doing what they've always been doing. And a lot of people get fired for taking chances, and there's people just afraid to take chances. That's my guess.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think, look, you have the Green family has come in and put a lot of money behind your network to distribute.
But they're not buying radio stations.
Pardon me?
They're not buying radio stations.
No, they're not buying radio stations, but
whereas you have Salem Broadcasting that owns radio stations in all of those markets, and they've got conservatives on the air in all those stations.
Well, again, because I think that the business model is working better. I think that the people who put them on are doing
But their ratings are a fraction of our ratings. They can't be making as much money as we're making.
And yet
they exist in every major market.
Well, so you're telling me in Philadelphia, for instance, there's not one station, independent station, that isn't willing to put you on with your good ratings because you're too progressive, and so they're concerned about that?
I'm not sure. That's why I asked you the question. I'm trying to figure it out.
I don't buy it.
Okay. Roger Arnoff, people can read more about it over at Accuracy and Media, AIM.org. Roger, thanks for being on the program with us.
Thank you very much.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
Is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Civil rights leaders are a pain in the neck. Can't hold a candle to Chiang Kai-shek. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Man, the bombers are afraid of a fight. Peace hurts business and that ain't right. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Daily News, Daily Blues. Pick up a copy anytime you choose. Seven little pennies.
Yeah, but can you trust the Daily News? Are you getting all the news? 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. If you want to drop by our live chat room, there's a link to it off airamerica.com on the Tom Hartman page, where we also have our blog. And also there's a link at the top of tomhartman.com. Also, I'm in Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour. The website for that, for the trailer, is 11th, like 11th, hour film.com. And also there's a trailer up at the top of our website at tomhartman.com if you want to see it. And we're going to be in L.A., New York, San Francisco, and possibly a few other cities we're looking at over the next few weeks, doing opening night kind of gigs with that movie. The premiere is in Los Angeles next Wednesday, and it's going to be a big deal. Leonardo DiCaprio is going to be there, and all kinds of cool stuff going on. 1-866-303-2270, your number. Andrew in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Speaking of Philadelphia, hey, Andrew.
Andrew? Hello, Tom?
Yes, you are on
Andrew.
The air.
Oh my God, this is great. I love your program. I love your Ancient Hours of Sunlight, you know, that book way back when.
Yeah, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. Thank you.
The reason I'm calling is because what you were just talking about is totally right on. I mean, there's no progressive radio in Philadelphia. And, you know, when he was talking, that last guy that was talking about, a conspiracy, you know what? I was thinking, I'll bet you it has to do with Richard Mallon Scaife, because they really had to keep Pennsylvania possibly for Bush in the last election. And you know what? They had Air America for a short, tiny slot in a black radio. What's his name? The guy that started it, you know, the humorous guy.
Yeah,
they had it for a couple of months. I discovered it by mistake and it was gone and I never saw a single ad for it. So there was no media campaign. And just while I'm driving along, I was realizing, you know, the last time we had progressive radio was Pacifica Radio, and they were really big for Mumia Abu-Jamal, and that they pulled the plug on that because of, you know, Daniel Faulkner. And that they got rid of Pacifica, and, you know.
So here's the question, Andrew. In a major media market like Philadelphia, where you've got, I'm guessing there's probably at least 40, 50, 60 stations in that market.
Yeah, and it's all
How do you prevent somebody who owns a radio station in Philadelphia, whether it's a big corporation or whether it's a local owner, how do you prevent them from carrying progressive talk radio?
Well, I don't know if my question to you is, how do we get them to do it?
Yeah, well, that's the better question. And the you know, at a certain level, I mean, you know, one of the questions that was asked is, you know, how is it that Michael Savage is on 200-300 stations and we're on like 70? And I think the easy glib answer to that is that conservative talk radio has been around for 15 years. There's a substantial and competent and very efficient machine associated with it of affiliate salespeople and you know, any radio station in any market knows that if they pick up conservative talk radio, it's been around long enough, it's not controversial enough anymore. I mean, in the early days, Limbaugh lost some stations because of things he said. That isn't happening anymore, so they know it's safe. They're concerned, I think, and this goes back to my theory about the herd mentality in the radio industry. I think there's some people who are concerned that it's just not safe, that they may end up being the recipients of the Bill O'Reilly treatment, and no station manager wants to walk out of his apartment or his house one day and find a Fox News camera in his face saying, yesterday Tom Hartman said, or yesterday Randy Rhodes said, you know, something like that. And you know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? I don't think that the people in this industry yet feel that it's safe. They know that conservative talk radio is safe.
Yeah, I think that your show would do fabulously well in Philadelphia. I know a lot of people. I try and get them to listen to it on the internet. But, I mean, I don't know anybody that listens to all those right-wing people, but you see ads for them all over the place. I mean,
it's just another format. Yeah, I think that it's what we're looking at is the maturity of the market. I mean, I've been on the air in Pittsburgh, in Pennsylvania, for 3 years, I believe. WPTT has been carrying our show. Yeah, they've been carrying our show back before I was with Air America. They've been carrying my show. And it's doing very well. And you know, we did a station visit down there last year. Did the show live from WPTT, and it's marvelous. And they also have a progressive host that precedes me, Lynn Cullen, and who's doing a great job. I'm of the opinion that it's just a matter of time, that as this format matures, as the markets mature, and as people in this industry figure out that there are ways to make progressive talk radio profitable, and there are ways to do it where it's not profitable, you know, put it on a little tiny stick, don't promote it, and don't bother to program the station, and it's not going to work. Well, the same would be true of any format, anything that you do. But Andrew, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it, and thank you for your kind words. And for listening to us there in Philadelphia, even though you've got to jump through some hoops in order to do that. 1-866-303-2270, Alan in Anaheim, California. Hey, Alan.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Just fine. I'm just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Oh, not a whole lot. I was listening for a few minutes. One of the things, I love Screwed, by the way. It's a great book.
Thank you.
It's a great book. I'm trying to get my wife to read it as well as our Madhouse, but she subscribes. Granted, she's 29. She still subscribes to the whole Goldwater Republican idea, based on the original concepts.
Yeah, you know, there is a strong ethical and moral basis, foundation in the old conservative movement, and I think that to just toss the entire thing out and make fun of it is a mistake. We need to acknowledge that and then say to those people, and by the way, the people who are now holding that flame of independence and liberty and individual rights are no longer the Goldwater conservatives. They're the liberals and progressives in America.
Very much so. But I was going to say is I know so. I was in Vegas about a month ago, Las Vegas, Nevada, and you guys don't have a progressive talk station out there.
Right.
And it'd be kind of, because I'm looking to move out there once I got my nursing license and go get my RN throughout there. But still, the fact is, it's like everything out there was nothing but right-wing talk on the entire AM dial.
Yeah. Probably the way that this is going to have to work, and it's probably going to have to come from a syndicator like Air America or Jones, although it would be really great if there was, you know, some sort of a national organization or, you know, some grassroots organization decided to take it on, is you look at a market like Las Vegas or like Philadelphia, you look at the ratings, which are not a secret, they're right out there where anybody can see them, Arbitron's ratings, and you find the 10 stations that are doing the worst in the market, the stations that have the absolute in the toilet ratings, and then you start trying to sell this format to them, you know, and start knocking
That's
on their
true.
Doors, and
you've got,
it's just.
Oh,
go ahead.
I was going to say, then you got scumbags out there like Mark Levin and Mike Savage and Larry Elder and some of those people who do nothing but preach hatred.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd call them scumbags, but there is a startling amount of hatred on right wing talk radio, unfortunately, and it's amazing that they will play that kind of stuff, and frankly, Air America I think is tame compared to some of that, and they think that this is just too experimental. No, it's not. This is a format that is working and is successful. Alan, thank you very much for the call, and it's just. Frankly, I think it's just a matter of time. I really do. Kay in Phoenix, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Hey, Kay. You are on the air. Okay.
Oh, hi. Hi, Tom. I know someone here in Phoenix. He is a salesperson. Of course, I'm not going to mention his name. He works for the right-wing station that carries Rush Limbaugh and so on here. And he and I had a conversation about sponsors. And he said that it's very unlikely for a sponsor to buy into the Air America station here. I believe it's Nova M. Because they're intimidated. They use intimidation tactics. They'll go to I won't even mention it. There is a store that you hear on the Nova M station all the time here, the left-wing station. He will go to them and tell them, you're going to lose customers. You're going to lose customers. You want to come over to us.
Yeah.
You want to come over to our station.
To the conservative station.
Oh, yeah. Sponsor intimidation is very common.
Yeah, no, I understand, and that's why I thought it was so tragic that, and Kay, thank you for that. That's why I thought it was so tragic that Bill O'Reilly decided to go after the sponsor of the Daily Kos. You would think that he knows better than that. You know, that we're all in this, all of us in commercial radio anyway, and in O'Reilly's case, commercial television as well, that, you know, we live and die with our sponsors. But the fact of the matter is that, well, for example, here in Portland, I don't want to name names because it's a conversation that was off the air, but one of our sponsors is a big mainstream business in this city. And he and I were talking one afternoon. In fact, we had lunch together and he said, I'm running ads and his ads are actually political. I mean, his ads say things like, you know, we want to help stop fascism in America. That's why we're advertising on this station. Now, come buy our product from us. And he said that he was expecting to get a lot of blowback from conservatives. And instead, what's happened is he's getting a lot of customers from liberals and progressives. And what he's discovered is that the conservatives, by and large, aren't listening. I mean, I think a lot of us used to believe the myth that liberals listen to conservative talk radio and therefore conservatives would listen to liberal talk radio. And in fact, people listen to talk radio primarily, A, to reinforce their worldview so that they can get a better, they can say, yeah, I knew that was right, but I didn't know exactly why. Now I know why. And two, so that they can get ammunition to win the water cooler wars so that they can, you know, sound intelligent and have a reasonable conversation with people that doesn't have to resort to yelling or whatnot. They can have the facts at their fingertips. And therefore, by and large, they're not so interested in listening to the opposing point of view. And even though for 15 years, Limbaugh was peddling that myth that everybody, including liberals, wanted to listen to the Limbaugh show. Turns out it ain't true. And from talking to advertisers, that's what I'm finding. And I've been doing this all over the country, visiting radio stations, talking to sponsors. And what we find is that those people who advertise on progressive talk radio are getting a strong response from progressives. And they're, by and large, being ignored by conservatives. That is to say, they're not getting trashed by conservatives. Because conservatives are not listening to progressive talk radio. 45, just like liberals are not listening to conservative talk radio. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
On Pat Tillman's death, in which the evidence doesn't match up with the friendly fire story?
Look, just because we lied about the way a famous soldier died, then prevented an investigation, then covered up the doctor's reports which contradicted our lie, then used his death to recruit more soldiers, then lied about our original lie, then shut down the investigation with executive privilege, then we, where was I, struck cover up propagandized lie of sarcasm. Oh yeah, support our troops.
What's up, TV, for that? Thanks a lot. Welcome back. Just quickly to close this topic, Dave in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Before the break, you mentioned something about arming oneself for the water cooler wars, which is going to cause me to go into my second point first. I think a lot of people will tolerate being lied to, but what they won't tolerate is being made to look foolish. You know, you don't see grown adults running around claiming that the Easter Bunny exists or Santa Claus. And I think what they're tired of from the right-wing radio is the fact that, you know, they're going around claiming that there's WMD, and they're made to look foolish. Right. I think it's slowly changing. I think the economics are working it out. I see today, across my business wire, Sinclair Broadcasting, second quarter profit plunges. They're down from 10 million in income to 2.2. This is the Sinclair Broadcasting was the Carrie film Stolen Honor.
Right.
Also the ones that refused to broadcast the Nightline reading of the names.
Right, and they do right-wing editorials every night.
Yep. And I think it's working, and everybody knows that Fox has been having a ratings problem for over a year now. I think in the market sense, what you're saying, if people don't have a choice, well, then they're probably just tuning out, and that's unfortunate, because I think they should have the choice of being able to hear the progressive side, and when they're given that chance, I think it works.
Yeah, but, well, it does, Dave, and it does very well in a lot of markets, particularly if you put it on a decent sized stick and promote it well. Dave, I got to move along. Thank you very much for the call. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. By the way, Heads Up TV was the HeadsUp.tv, the source for that that little skit there a few minutes ago. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, actually, I'm right here. Although they're all voting at Republican Radio Row, the House Republican Conference. That they are doing on Radio Row, and the major topic.
Hey, how come they didn't invite me?
Well, you know, I don't know. I didn't actually. We're actually doing the engineering, but we have nothing to do with the invitation list.
Well, you should let them know. You know, I did CPAC this last year.
I know. Well, we'll make sure you're there next time.
Not that I don't like doing the liberal ones, but I actually have more fun at the conservative ones because I get into, you know, fistfights with people and stuff on the
Well, actually, you know something, I got to tell you, the one thing that they're talking about the S-CHIP, which of course the Democrats desperately want to pass, and for a lot of
the Children's Health Insurance Program.
Right. But the point is that the Democrats did exactly what the Republicans do, which is they let go of this bill this morning. They expected them to vote on it before they recess on Sunday, and it's, you know, 450 pages long, which is exactly the same thing the Republicans did. And I have to say, in all fairness, that's just not right on either side.
Agreed.
But the issue is, of course, who they're going to insure, what the limits are, and whether the states make that decision or not, in terms of who gets funded and whether the states have the responsibility to decide what the income levels are. And I think that's frankly where the big rub is right now on that front. And it also has to do with increasing taxes, albeit cigarette taxes and cigar taxes and that kind of thing.
Isn't really, though, the bottom line? I
told one Republican, I don't care if they increase the cigar taxes to $1,000 a cigar.
isn't the bottom line, though, that even though Republicans are invoking things like states' rights, which is a traditional conservative mantra, and frankly, I think, you know, a lot of liberals are in support of states' rights, too. It's the, you know, the Ninth and Tenth Amendments are pretty explicit about that. But nonetheless, they're invoking these things. But the real agenda is that they don't want any more what they would refer to as creeping socialism. They don't want any more people to be covered by government-paid health insurance in the United States.
That's clearly it. That you have 100%.
Yeah,
that's exactly what it is. A couple other things today, this morning, several talk show hosts, Republican talk show hosts, namely conservative talk show hosts, met with the president. Don't have a readout about that yet, but there was an Oval Office off-the-record discussion with the president, just like the president did with conservatives earlier last week, et cetera, conservative columnists, et cetera. So that went on today, and we'll be hearing more about that on some conservative programs. Nancy Pelosi said this morning that they're going to hopefully try and get that FISA reform passed this week. I'm very unsure about that because I think they may be giving too much to the administration.
Ellen, if I could just take you back just a little bit before you go forward. You said that the president met with conservative reporters.
Radio hosts.
Radio hosts, okay. Has there ever been a president in the history of the United States who applied a political litmus test to reporters or news media before he would talk with them?
Well, in some respects, I have to say that Clinton did a lot of these off the records as well, and he did them with like-minded reporters. And so, yes, I'm going to have to say, yes, in terms of the off the records, they've absolutely been. That was exactly the way the Clinton administration did it. Hate to say it, but that's.
Well, no, it's, you know, the truth is the truth.
You know, I have to tell you, I was the recipient of that stuff, so I was happy when it was happening to me.
Right, but now you're on the outside, and
yes,
so am I.
Now I'm on the outside looking in.
Yeah.
But Clinton, I think, was definitely one of the first to do it, and the Bush administration carried out. I mean, he would meet with these reporters, often television reporters, off the record, et cetera. And that definitely happened.
Yeah. Okay.
So, also, former Secretary Rumsfeld testified on the Tillman issue this morning, which I know you were just talking about, and he said that he had no recollection that anyone said to me that families should not be told the truth or that it was possibly friendly fire. So he's in the no recollection situation.
Right. And he also said that he would not engage in a cover-up, as if he was speaking in the abstract. He never said that he did not engage in a cover-up. I thought that was a very careful choice of words.
Well, yes, but then he also gave the no recollection thing, which is another, doesn't get you in any trouble.
Right, another very careful choice of words, which leads us to suspect that possibly, I mean, did anybody ask him right up front, did you engage in a cover-up?
I don't think so, and because our radio row here was not able to stand there the whole time. But you're right, he was very careful, and you know he decided to testify at the last minute last night.
Oh, that's interesting. Very interesting. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, their website, just a ton of great news information there. Ellen, thanks so much for being with
us. Thank you.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up next, in our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, we're talking pirates, matey.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. You're tuned into the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Well, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you're not sure about what you know, and sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes you know what you don't know, and sometimes even everything you know is wrong. You know?
But you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync.
And things that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could be, with thanks to the Firesign Theater for that. Is everything you know about pirates wrong? Colin Woodard is here. He has a new book out called The Republic of Pirates. Colin, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here.
The history of piracy tends to be told in much like the history of indigenous and aboriginal people, strangely enough. You know, Native Americans, for example, tends to be told in very stark terms that are highly polar. Either they are evil, nasty SOBs who robbed, raped, pillaged, and generally had no right to exist, or they were noble savages who had the earliest democracies and had a code of honor among themselves, and life was good. And the portrait that you portray in your book, The Republic of Pirates, really, I don't want to say gives the lie to both, but sort of highlights the fact that there is no really simple story about it. In fact, there's been a series of transitions that piracy has gone through.
Yeah, absolutely. And my particular book is about a certain gang of pirates who all knew one another, who had served together, who operated out of a shared base in the Bahama Islands for just a five-year period between 1715 and 1720, but surprisingly are responsible for virtually all of our pirate imagery and the inspiration for all the pirates, you know, from Long John Silver all the way through to Jack Sparrow. And this particular group was distinct from many of the pirates who came before and came since, and then a lot of those, noble savage argument you were making, a lot of that does in fact apply to this group. They were up to more than simple banditry, which I would argue most pirates in history have been.
Now, this is Blackbeard actually established this base, did he not?
He's one of them. The group includes a lot of your pantheon of pirate greats: Blackbeard, Sam Bellamy of the Widder Wreck fame, the gentleman pirates Stede Bonnet, the women pirates Mary Read and Anne Bonny. A whole slew of the most famous of the pirates were in this particular group.
And in your book, you say that they undertook nothing less than a social and political revolt, rebelling against oppression, and were quite effective at this.
Yeah, this was a... they saw themselves as being involved in a social revolt and a sort of Robin Hood's men. They were fighting against the ship owners and ship captains who'd made their lives miserable, because most of them had been sailors in the Navy or the Merchant Marine. Conditions on both were absolutely terrible. People were there was enormous violence and people were cheated out of their wages and there wouldn't be enough food stocked on vessels sometimes and crews would starve and so on and so forth. They had plenty of grievances. But the telling thing is that most people in the Americas seems to have bought the pirates' argument. All the authorities, you know, people like Governor Alexander Spotswood in Virginia and the Attorney General of South Carolina and Cotton Mather in Massachusetts are all fuming in their letters, which have survived, about, you know, how these people are villains of all nations and demons and how terrible they are and we must extirpate them from the seas. But at the same time, in the same letters, they're all complaining that a great number of people in their respective colonies do in fact look upon them as heroes and seem to be rooting for them.
Well, and in fact, in the past, some nations had hired pirates. I mean, wasn't Henry Morgan hired by the British to go after Spanish ships as a tactic of sub-hot war?
Yeah, and that's another element that makes this group of pirates distinct from Sir Henry Morgan and from Sir Francis Drake and Captain Kidd, the sort of sea dogs and buccaneers of a previous generation. All of those guys were, as you say, privateers. They had permission to do what they were doing. Their sovereign said, you know, in time of war, I want you to act as mercenaries and attack enemy shipping. And so they were rewarded for what they did. They weren't outlaws of all nations. It's Sir Henry Morgan for a reason. He was knighted for what he did and made lieutenant governor of Jamaica. These other
And Captain Kidd worked for the British East India Company until they figured out that he was working against him, and they had him arrested and hanged.
Yeah, he was hired as a privateer, and he didn't perhaps manage his relationships with his superiors very well, and they ended up ganging up on him, just like you say.
Yeah. Now, the two other points that I think are really interesting that you're making in your book, one is that these guys could be incredibly violent and vicious. And it sort of, in a way, reminds me of those, you know, what we're seeing in Iraq, in fact, at a certain level, that when violence is visited upon people, those people tend to become violent.
Yeah, it was an incredibly vicious time. And the more you read about the early 1700s, the more shocking it is. I mean, you read about what the pirates did sometimes, and there were some violent sociopaths among this gang of pirates. A lot of them were very discreet in their use of force, but not all of them. But when you start going and looking at what conditions were like in London at the time and how the established legal societies around the pirates were operating, like Barbados and South Carolina and Jamaica, which were perfected slave societies. Jamaica, the Europeans were already outnumbered by their slaves 8-1, and the repressive measures required to allow that to continue were just staggering. And so the more you start reading about the sort of violence and inequities and that were taking place in regular society, the pirates start looking relatively good by comparison, although it's all a bit shocking to many modern readers.
Yeah, we're talking with Colin Woodard. His website, Colin Woodard, WOODARD.com. His new book, Pirate Republic. King George I decided that he was going to drive a stake through the heart of piracy in general and this community that you write about as well by saying that he would offer an amnesty to any pirates who wanted to renounce their pirateness and that they could come back to civilization. What was the result of this?
It was sort of a bait-and-switch program to try to defeat the pirates, which was put to the king by Woodes Rogers, who was the man who brought the pirates down in the title of the book. And the idea was to sort of divide and conquer. If you could get some of the pirates had gotten so powerful that they were threatening the colonies themselves. Many of them had vessels as powerful as any that the Royal Navy had in the Americas. They'd cut off the commerce of the empire. They'd become an extremely destabilizing force. So something had to be done. And Woodes Rogers had suggested that you try to divide them by getting some of them, offering them a blanket amnesty for everything they'd done to date. And the effect was when the pirates were confronted with this, a large number of them, maybe about half of the pirates, ended up taking the pardon, at least initially. Some of them went back into piracy even after a few weeks, because you know, they figured maybe they could get away with it, and at least they had some legal argument that that they'd reformed. But some of them did, in fact, take it. And the effect of it was that it split the ranks enough to make it possible for Woodes Rogers and other agents of the empire to eventually pacify the Bahamas and put an end to this what's called the Golden Age of Piracy.
Colin Woodward, his book, The Republic of Pirates, being the true and surprising story of the Caribbean pirates and the man who brought them down. Colin, what are the lessons for today in your book?
I don't know if I would say lessons for today are quite the way I'd go at it. It's more that this is a fascinating view for me into what ordinary people were thinking and feeling a good 60 or 70 years before the American Revolution. I mean, that sort of mob, that mob revolutionary sentiment, or kind of radical democracy of the street that started the Boston Tea Party and triggered the Boston Massacre and led to the storming of the Bastille at the beginning of the French Revolution.
Yeah, at this point in time, there had not been a democracy for almost 3,000 years.
Yeah, I mean, this is long before any of these ideas are supposed to be around, and yet both the pirates and their supporters seem to have been responding already to being hostile to what was happening in the empire and the increasing disparities between the privileged few and the many, and the sort of tearing apart of the social contract from the Middle Ages between manor and serf. And
do you think that Do you think that the pirate community that you were writing about was responding to the writers of the Enlightenment like Locke and Rousseau the same way that the revolutionaries of North America were? Or was it just in the air? I mean, you know, how is it that they were?
I don't think that they were probably in general. Most of them were probably not well-read and not aware of those ideas. And nor do I think that most of the people who stormed the Bastille or were taking part in the mob violence in Boston at the beginning of the Revolution were necessarily either. It may have been in the air to a certain extent, but I think they were well aware that they were being exploited and that the way the empire was being run was to the disadvantage of ordinary people, and they wanted to fight back, and there was already enough anger to motivate some of them to do very, very radical things.
Well said. Colin Woodard, the book, his new book, The Republic of Pirates, being the true and surprising story of the Caribbean pirates and the man who brought them down. His website, Colin Woodard, WOODARD.com. Colin, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Yeah, it's called the Republican Party. 21 minutes past the hour. Oh, my. Hey, want to voice your progressive opinion, but maybe you're too nervous to do it on the radio, or maybe you just can't get through, the lines are jammed. You want to share your thoughts, pick up a phone and call us, 503-323-6620. We want to hear from you in 30 seconds or less, and you never know, your diatribe may just make it on the air. So make it count, 503-323-6620. Here's a comment from our comment line from yesterday.
People talk about withdrawing from Iraq and the huge cost in time and money. I wonder if anybody has measured the ongoing cost of the war every day against that cost. It seems to me it might be really cheaper to get rid of the war and just bite the bullet as far as leaving equipment and so on over there, as opposed to all the money that we're putting into additional and new equipment now.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, just to add on to that, the U.S. government, this Dateline Baghdad from the Middle East Times, the U.S. government cannot account for 190,000 weapons issued to Iraqi security forces in 2004 and 2005, according to an investigation carried out by the Government Accountability Office, the GAO. And so this, you know, 100,000 AK-47s, 135,000 pieces of body armor, 115,000 helmets, 80,000 pistols, all missing. Now, my guess is that this is stuff that they gave to Iraqi soldiers when they were training them. And then the soldiers said, thanks a lot for the training. Thanks a lot for the equipment. See you later. I'm going off to join my local Sunni or Shia militia. because the military has been very aggressive about making sure the soldiers coming home get hit with the bill for whatever they may have lost. But the government not commenting on that, other than that they seem to be missing about more or less $20 billion worth of stuff, and they're not sure where it went. Well, the Pentagon has got $2 trillion now in aggregate that it can't account for, so we shouldn't be surprised. Another story, this in today's Financial Times, I thought this was particularly interesting. The headline, German industry chief attacks France's vision. The article by Bertrand Benoit, he says, Germany's leading industry lobbyist warned Berlin yesterday not to follow France's lead in raising the state's influence on the economy in response to the challenges of globalization. Now, this is really interesting. The leading industry lobbyist in Germany is saying, don't put up protectionist barriers. Well, of course, an industry lobbyist would say that. Right? I mean, you would expect that. In fact, they say Mr. Thumann, whose family business, Heitkamp and Thumann Group, controls more than 50% of the world market for battery components. You know, okay, so that's who this guy is. And what he's talking about is the fact that the French are saying, we're going to limit things coming into France that are not made in France. And we're going to limit foreign companies from buying French industries. And he says, this German guy, on the one hand, he says, we cannot on the one hand call for liberalization and deregulation of European energy markets, while on the other hand, granting France an exemption. Now, he's criticizing Sarkozy, the new president of France, the new prime minister of France, for his protectionist tone. And yet, at the same time, now this is where it gets very strange. This guy who is the head lobbyist, one of the most powerful lobbyists in Germany, who's saying we have to have open borders, free trade. Yes, indeed. At the same time, he does not want the Chinese government, because there's a bunch of governments, China, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates. There's a bunch of governments that are not democratic governments that are controlling over $2.5 trillion worth of sovereign wealth funds. Because these are governments that actually own many of the industries that operate in them. They're controlling, they're sitting on $2.5 trillion, and they're starting to take that money and buy companies in other countries. And he doesn't want that to happen in Germany. He doesn't want his own company, apparently, to be the victim of a hostile takeover from China. He says, in the same article, I mean, this is just such a, it just makes your head spin. He says, we support the free movement of capital and oppose all barriers to investment. Our motto is no protectionism. However, the only thing I'm saying is that when state funds, for example, when Russia or China, seek to invest in key industries or companies in Germany and other countries, this is the German lobbyist, then I can understand that the government sees a certain need for control. Oh, man, it is. I mean, whose ox is gored, right? I mean, that's the bottom line. That's what this all boils down to. So here you have, and in fact, they note in the Financial Times in this article today, Mr. Thumann is less preoccupied with potential threats to national security and more concerned about foreign states siphoning off know-how and patents. In other words, he doesn't give a damn about the future of Germany. He just wants to make sure that his company's profits are protected, which, you know, is pretty much the line of most lobbyists and most transnational corporations. Again, this is the guy who is the most powerful lobbyist in Germany, and his company controls 50% of the worldwide market for certain types of batteries. So he's saying, yes, global free trade, it's a wonderful thing, but not if they want to buy us. So I guess even the industrialists are starting to wake up. Although it's just so bizarre. The first two-thirds of this entire article is devoted to protectionism is a bad thing. We all agree on that. The French are making a mistake in being protectionist. When it comes to these sovereign wealth funds, maybe we should be protectionist. Maybe we should be paying attention to this. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. What happens to kids when their fathers go off to war? That and your calls right after.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Come, you masters of war. You that build the big guns,
Yeah, they build the death planes. Yeah, they build all the bombs. Yeah, they hide behind walls. Yeah, they hide behind disks. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks.
34 minutes past the hour. Greg Zaroya, writing in the front page of today's Wall Street Journal, or excuse me, the front page of USA Today today. Army wives whose husbands are deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan have committed markedly higher rates of child neglect and abuse than when their spouses are at home, according to a new study that was published yesterday in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Child neglect was almost four times greater during periods when the husbands were at war. Physical abuse was nearly twice as high. A large part of this has to do with inappropriate supervision, which may have to do with mothers having to work while their husbands are gone. That's my conclusion, not the USA Today's. But they're defining neglect as failing to meet a child's basic needs, such as nourishment and sanitation. Amy Lambert, an Army wife at Fort Stewart, Georgia, says, I firmly believe that more time at home between deployments would be the most beneficial solution. Many spouses are lonely, scared, and or tired. All the more the tragedy. All the more the tragedy. Let's take a quick look at what's going on with the situation, with the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance.
Following our security developments in Iraq as of 18:30 Greenwich Mean Time today, Wednesday, August 1st, Baghdad, Dateline Baghdad, 25 bodies were found dumped around Baghdad in the past 24 hours, police said. A suicide bomber in Baghdad killed 50 people and wounded 60 after luring motorists to a fuel truck near a gas station in Baghdad's western Mansour district. In Baghdad, a suicide car bomb killed 20 people and wounded 40 near Al-Hariya Square in the Karada district in central Baghdad. In Baghdad, a parked car bomb killed 3 people and wounded 6 others in the Al-Harthiya district of central Baghdad near the Green Zone. In Madayan, gunmen planted several bombs inside a residential building and blew it up, killing 4 civilians and wounding 6 others. Excuse me. In Baghdad, a U.S. soldier was killed by small arms fire on Tuesday in eastern Baghdad. In Iskandariya, a roadside bomb killed 1 Iraqi soldier and wounded 3 others. In Baghdad, Nineveh Province Police Chief Wathiq al-Hamadani escaped a roadside bomb attack on his convoy in Mosul. 4 people, however, including 2 policemen, were wounded in that incident. In Baghdad, Iraqi soldiers killed 11 insurgents and arrested 89 during the past 24 hours. In Baghdad, a parked car bomb killed 3 people and wounded 5 in Baghdad's southern Dura district. In Basra, a British soldier was killed when a roadside bomb struck an armored warrior vehicle on routine patrol in that city. In Baghdad, 3 U.S. soldiers were killed and 6 wounded when a roadside bomb detonated near their patrol in eastern Baghdad, according to U.S. military sources. In Balada, suspected al-Qaeda insurgents kidnapped 18 Shiite men at a fake checkpoint. In Baghdad, the bodies of 19 people were also found in different parts of southern Baghdad. And in Baghdad, gunmen killed Major General Mahir Nouri, a senior traffic police officer, in a drive-by shooting in central Baghdad. These, the security developments of the last 24 hours, reported by Reuters. 1-866-303-2270. Our telephone number, and Eileen in Kensington, Maryland. Hey, Eileen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I'm nervous, so, and I have a question. So if I could ask it and get your help, because about a month ago you did, you were on the radio and you said that it was up to you, you and you, and we had to get involved. And if we don't, then we've dropped the ball. So I started to get involved. I've inspired my friends and family in circle. We're doing petitions and so forth. And I was on trying to find a national movement, and so far I can't have it. But the real question I have is that I want to know if it's too late. Have we already lost our constitution? Because the partisan political machine seems to be complete. It seems like everything is in place because the vote don't matter. I mean, it's not a question of lobbyist, media, corporation, or anything. It's like whether it's Republicans or Democrats, they don't give us anything. I mean, I'm old enough to remember that at least a year before election, they felt the heat and they had to. They couldn't earmark or they couldn't accommodate lobbyists because they had to get elected. But now they don't even do that. I mean, Bush is at 30%, and the Intelligence Committee caved in because of Bush's power. I mean, what power can you have at 30% with a year and a half of to go in an administration? And right. The answer to the earlier topic about why the progressive talks can't go, it's because the corporations, when you control the airwaves, when you control the media, then you make money. It doesn't matter that they lose money on a radio show. They're making money all the way.
Yeah. Eileen, first of all, I think it's important that we put this all in a historical context. When John Adams was president, our second president, the guy who followed George Washington and preceded Thomas Jefferson, he pushed through the Alien and Sedition Acts and put in jail 20 newspaper editors who wrote against him, who spoke out against him, including Ben Franklin's grandson, Benjamin Franklin Bach. And it was a terrible time, a very, very dark time in America. And many of the founders, including Thomas Jefferson, were concerned, who was vice president, by the way, only because he got the second most votes. This was back before people ran together on a ticket. And you know, we're concerned that it was the end of democracy in America. But in the Revolution of 1800, Jefferson was elected, and the first thing he did was strike down the Alien and Sedition Acts. Actually, it expired on March 4th of that year. It did not renew it. And let all those newspaper editors out of jail and apologized to them and gave many of them reparations. We've seen, in the Civil War, this nation went through a terrible, I mean, an unbelievable agony. And Abraham Lincoln took many iron-fisted measures, including suspending habeas corpus, that he felt were necessary to hold the republic together, but a lot of people thought were the beginning of fascism or tyranny in the United States. In World War I, the Democratic president, Woodrow Wilson, put people in prison for speaking out against the war. In World War II, the Democratic president, Franklin Roosevelt, put people in concentration camps, the Japanese, on the west coast of the United States. I mean, and then during the McCarthy era in the 1950s, you had people in the media not just afraid to speak out, but being punished for having spoken out 20 years earlier for things that they did in their childhood. We have, in the United States, there have been many times when we have stepped into the darkness, shall we say, and under both parties, as you correctly point out. And the fact of the matter is that in every case, because we're still here, we have come back from that. And I believe that what we are seeing right now is such a groundswell and such a rising up that we are going to come back from this. I really believe that. Just history tells me that this is nothing compared to the Civil War. This is nothing compared to the Alien Sedition Acts. And yet it's terrible. It's terrible what's going on. And we need to fight it with everything we have. In terms of institutions or organizations that you can participate with, first of all, I'd commend to you your local political parties, the Green Party, the Democratic Party, even the Republican Party, if you're inclined. But participating with organized parties. And secondly, Jim Dean's organization, Democracy for America, they have chapters all over the United States. I would think that they would have to have one near Kensington, Maryland. And if not, I'm sure they'd love you to start one. DemocracyForAmerica.com is their website. Okay. Is that a good start?
Okay, can I ask just one more question?
Sure.
Okay, I agree with everything you said, but how could you explain that in the year 2000, a candidate for president who could not even put a sentence together, who won none of the debates, was elected as president?
He was not elected. He was put into power by the Supreme
That's
Court.
That's my point. That's my point, Tom.
No, it was a coup. In my opinion, the 2000 election was a coup, and shame on the Democrats for not calling it out. And the 2004 election was stolen in Ohio, and now we're finding that in about half the counties in Ohio, they've already destroyed the election records in violation of state and federal law. We've seen stolen elections. We've seen mind-boggling levels of crime done by this administration and their cronies and their handmaidens and in government and in industry. And the good news, Eileen, is that you and I are talking about it. The good news is that people are writing about it. The good news is that you can walk in any bookstore in America right now and find books on this. The good news is that John Conyers wrote a book laying out how the election of 2004 the election of 2000 was stolen. This is not a secret. This is and there is pushback, and it's a pushback, frankly, that I think is on the level of the Revolution of 1800. I think that the next election, 2008, we're going to see something like the Revolution of 1800, and that's why institutional money, power money, corporate money is starting to move toward the Democrats. I'm not sure that that's necessarily a wonderful thing, but it's a sign of the fact that the power is shifting in the United States. So the essential thing for people like you and me to do right now, Eileen, is to get into the Democratic Party so that when and as they move into a position where they have some actual real power, we can hold them accountable from within.
So, why did Conyers renege on impeachment now that he's
I'm not sure he has. He has not said no to it. He has said not yet. And so, I can't speak for John Conyers. All I know is we have to get active. Thank you, Eileen, and thanks for what you're doing. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. There is a war. There is a war between the ones who say there is a war and the ones who say there is one. But though you come on back to the war.
Couple of quick and fascinating points made by listeners regarding our debate on the minimum wage yesterday. Chris writes in, he says, I've heard many conservatives of late refute a minimum wage update by throwing out a number so high, and your show this morning is $100, to prove the basic proposition of an increasing minimum wage wrong and use that as a launching pad to spin off into a rant on communist price fixing. Limits testing has its place. Progressives can just as easily use limits test to refute lower taxes. 0 and 100% are both equally absurd. But the absurdity of the $100 minimum is only self-evident by its definition of a minimum wage must be relevant to the cost of living. Which are fixed by the free market, not by the government. Yeah, good point, number one. And number two, and this is from Don, I thought even a better point. He says, high tax rates for the wealthy require higher efficiency and more investments in tax-deductible assets. If tax rates are too low, the money can just lay around in less productive securities. In Central America, for example, where 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth, tax rates are very low, requiring very little effort on the part of the wealthy to produce efficiency. Well, that's an interesting argument. We need to increase the top marginal tax rates because it will increase the efficiency of the wealthy. Makes sense to me. Michael Moore calling out Rudy Giuliani. This is just great over at michaelmoore.com saying, hey, Rudy.
Hello, Mr. Giuliani. It's Michael Moore. Remember me? Listen. Remember those 9/11 rescue workers, all our heroes who were there at Ground Zero trying to save people's lives? They were there without the proper radio phones. There was no communication center for them to be in communication with each other because you'd chosen to build it in the World Trade Center after it had been bombed the first time back in 1993. And now you want to be president of the United States. Well, those 9/11 heroes, a lot of them are suffering right now. A lot of them need medical care. And You have refused to help them. In fact, you've refused to even talk to them. For 3 months now, they've been trying to talk to you, our 9/11 heroes. Would you please talk to them? Would you please assist them? Would you please do something for them? Thank you.
Yeah. Giuliani called out by Michael Moore. God bless you, Michael Moore. 1-866-303-2270. Paula in Carbondale, Illinois, listening on WINI, one of our affiliates we've been on for about 4 years, I think. Hey, Paula.
Hey, Tom, and also WINI is locally owned, and when they say something controversial, they offer equal time to opposing opinions, and that's why I'm calling. I think I am totally for the fairness doctrine, and I think that when you had that guy from Accuracy Media on, and he admitted that the reason right-wing radio has taken off is because Reagan destroyed the fairness doctrine, that you should rethink your position, whose side are you on? And I just wanted to make one poll that I saw. There are more people this year who believe that Saddam Hussein was responsible for 9/11 than there were last year. So that is the power of the lies, and we need to be able to confront those lies and you know, get on the radio and say, no, this is not true.
Yeah, I agree with that. And the
radio station
that you're listening to regarding the Fairness Doctrine is run by Dale and Nancy. I don't know if they want their last names put out, so I won't. But they're doing a great job, and they put this program on the air back some 4 years ago, as I recall, because there's also conservative programming on their station, and it's in a small community in Carbondale, Illinois, and they wanted both sides to be heard. And I salute that, and I think that that's a great testimonial to what happens when you have local people owning local media.
Yeah, well, I appreciate all you're doing, Tom, but I think you feel this fight is a, you know, it's an enlightenment thing. You get your speech out there and the right-wingers get their speech out there, but it's not an equal playing field. And so maybe you're biased because you feel that you're fighting a good fight, but you're fighting it from a hole in the ground that the right wing has dug. And it is a conspiracy. We know they got together in the 70s, set up the Heritage Foundation and bought out radio. And I've heard from you that Rush Limbaugh, you know, didn't make any money for 10 years. Well,
I never said that, but it was when he started. He did not have any sponsors, and he started on 55 stations. But you know, Paula, your point is well taken, and I think that we could argue it either from the point of view of the Fairness Doctrine or local ownership. But I think WINI is a great example of local ownership, and it's a marvelous and very well run radio station. I'm proud to be on it, and proud to have been on it all these years. And I thank you for calling, Obi in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hey, Obi.
Hi, this is Obi.
I
really appreciate all your talk on globalization, and I'm a kind of a protectionist, and the reason is national security. That's a great reason to bring up to conservative people who are all for globalization. If we become dependent on foreign sources for food, all of a sudden the supply lines get cut off. We have no more food.
And that would be an issue of survival, and in fact, increasingly is becoming one, because much of the food that we produce in the United States is actually feed for cattle, and we can't eat it. But there's a visible example of that is, for example, the guys who are patrolling the southern border with Mexico, which the right wingers are all, you know, oh yeah, we got to stop all these brown people from coming. You know, they're all hysterical about. The border patrol uniforms are made in Mexico. How ironic is that, right? We cannot build an aircraft carrier right now without parts from China. We can't build a missile right now without parts from China. That's how, you know, so you're absolutely right, Abhi, and it is a national security issue, and it needs to be more frequently framed in that context. Spot on. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be challenging conservative Dan Gaynor, who's going to be here saying that the media's solution to wrong behavior like smoking, drinking, and eating junk food is putting a tax on cigarettes, alcohol, and unhealthy. Well, what do you want to do, Dan? Put these people in jail? Jessica Valenti here on Full Frontal Feminism. Christy Harvey from the Center for American Progress. News Below the Radar. That and your calls, plus the best of the rest of the news. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.